As companies, we're pretending that people are working 8 hours a day. They're not. Let's just accept that reality. Let's just accept that people are working 3.5 hours a day, because that's the truth. We essentially can use AI to make up the other 4.5 hours.
Welcome to the Disrupted Workforce Podcast, where we focus on the intersection of the human experience, AI, and the future of work.
Our mission is to help you prepare, navigate, and thrive.
If you're ready to take the next step, visit thedisruptedworkforce.com. Now, let's drop into today's episode. TDW fans, we are excited to have Claire Hadar on the show today. She is the co-founder of Wonder and Pattern, and you may know her from her brilliant TED Talk, The Future of Work is Chaos. Claire has dedicated her career to understanding and challenging how humans work with a passion for figuring out how to maximize the intersection of technology, human capability, and systems to shape behaviors and work cultures. Claire, welcome to TDW.
Nate, Alex, it's just so good to be here with you guys today. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Claire, you had no idea when you gave that TED Talk how right you would be and how much disruption was going to happen.
Nearly eight years ago.
Yeah, 8 years ago. Yeah. And I'm sure for a lot of people, it felt like chaos. Well, fast forward to 2024. We would like to know, what new insights have you gleaned over, specifically over the last 4 years and kind of all the disruption that we've gone through? What would you say are your latest insights?
Nothing's changed. How bizarre is that? So let me go into that because I don't think anybody's expecting me to say that. So here's what I didn't include in that TED Talk, which was actually a very big piece of my research that led up to what was summarized in a 15-minute TED Talk. And the piece is, ultimately, we've gone through this like game-changing, altering, you know, reality experiment that we've gone through, you know, with COVID. And it's no different to any other type of change that the world has ever gone through. And so the reality is that we're still going through exactly the same change cycle that all humans go through every time they face change. You know what I mean? So whether you've lost a spouse or you're changing a job or you're moving, you know what I mean? You go through this change cycle. And that change cycle has actually been researched by Kubler and Ross significantly. It's morphed. A lot of people are most familiar with it in the form of the grief cycle. You know what I mean? And yes. One of the things that I knew was very, very clearly going to happen, and I didn't know when I did that TED Talk that it was going to be COVID, but I knew that there was going to be some shakeup event that was going to cause this significant chaos. And what's going to happen on the other side of that is that we're going to go into that like a really, really big dip, which all the research points us to. And people are going to spend at least 2 to 3 years trying to go back to the way things were before. Yes. And we are right in the middle of it.
Yes.
And hence my nothing has changed. And so you can actually really see, and I mean, you guys know this, you're out there in the industry, you're seeing it. You can speak to any business leader today and they'll tell you that. Like literally right now, the world is trying to pretend that COVID didn't happen and that everything didn't change. We're grappling, we're trying to go back to working in the office the way we did before. We're trying to use tools in the same way that we did, and it's just not going to work. But we've got to feel the pain of that before we actually move through the rest of the cycle. And that's where the new insights are going to start coming from. So I think a really, really key piece, and again, I think we'll all feel this at a very intuitive level, is that biology and people's physiological well-being can no longer be divorced from work. It's how people actually show up on a daily basis is really going to impact work moving forward. And if you think about it, is let's actually play this scenario out practically. Okay. We're going to be working alongside robots. whether we want that or not. Okay.
For yes. sure.
100%.
Okay. If, yes. if you aren't thinking that, then yes. you've got to very quickly get on with that reality. You're going to be interviewing next to robots, and you're most likely going to be hired alongside a robot. You're going to have a robot companion in some shape or form, if not multiple robot companions. And so within that reality, you've got to realize that robot has got significant competitive advantage over you straight off the bat. Okay. And so because of that, because they don't have a stamina issue like you do, you know what I mean? They don't have a memory getting full issue like you do. There's a few limitations that we as humans are going to be facing that they are
they
not
don't
facing.
Get sick. They don't get, and they don't sleep. Take vacation. They don't need sleep. Yeah.
They don't have kids.
Yeah. All of it. None of that stuff. And so I think front and center, and this is actually something that I didn't quite realize how significant it would be, but I think that's going to become one of the biggest issues is, how do I hire healthy people? How do I become part of ensuring that they stay healthy? And how does my workplace, whether I'm a senior leader, whether I'm an HR manager, how do I make sure that my workplace is healthy? And the reason why this is such a It's a massive topic, because our laws that protect people actually prevent workplaces from getting involved in this area because of all the HIPAA laws and everything like that around privacy. Okay, so we've actually got a very big legal barrier facing us here. And then the second thing is, we just are literally for millennia and millennia and millennia have been taught that isn't part of work. That's your private life. And that is such a significant mind shift to go, am I going to be willing to give my employer this data so that they can actually monitor me? You know what I mean? Am I going to be this? There's so much gray that we haven't like navigated at all, you know? And just to give you guys an example, like today in the US, literally right now, the Senate and the House is debating a huge bill around surveillance. Okay. And they're trying to expand a bill to see, can the government survey their people more than they already are? You know what I mean? It's being debated like right now. And so there's these legal barriers where law hasn't even been defined. That's the crystal ball, if I was to call it that, is that there's a lot of disruption that has to happen there and a lot of integration between work and the actual physical human that's going to kind of like move us into this next phase of work.
And the interplay of privacy in that, it's an interesting kind of two-sided coin. We want to be healthier at work. People realizing this is critical. I mean, if the last 4 years haven't taught us that, they've taught us nothing. However, on the flip side of that is this, well, how deep into my world are you going to dig? And am I okay with that? Right. So I guess we're all going to have to, at some level, come to terms with this.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and if you take it to its extreme, and it actually isn't even an extreme, it's a reality today. I mean, Neuralink as a company exists. They are busy implanting devices into people as we speak. And if you look at that type of company, and Neuralink isn't the only company that's doing it. I mean, there's multiple companies that are playing around with that type of tech right now. Are you comfortable? Will you go tomorrow and go and have a device implanted into you that can and will read your thoughts? And will you use that device to create work? Like, that is the question that's facing us right now. Wow. You know? Yeah. Like, think of, I don't know if you guys are watching the series on Netflix, The Three-Body Problem.
No, it's one of the most expensive series ever, though. I know they invested a lot of money.
I haven't even heard of it.
Yeah, they're promoting it heavily. Yes,
I highly recommend that anybody listening to this podcast and the two of you, that you guys go and actually watch that. It's a highly entertaining series, but all of that aside, it is actually an eerily scary look into what our future actually holds.
I'm pumped for that.
Yeah.
I want to ask a question around surveillance and tracking. So we had Mark Bryan on the show. He's a futurist with the Future Today Institute, and he's become a friend of ours. Great guy, great mind. And he was talking about sort of the next level of biometric trackers that we're going to have at work. And when your computer or watch is going to say, you know, hey, Alex, maybe you need to stretch right now or you need to walk around. And then this bigger question that you're bringing up around how much, you know, what is that interplay between, you know, my data and my privacy and my company's data look like? And the next layer of that is there's an idea that's floating around that real heart-centered leadership and that real engagement at the employee level is, I know a lot about you. So Claire, I know how you spend your time when you're not at work. I know about your family. I have a good sense of what you did over the weekend. And that's the way that if we're working together, that I build trust and cohesion. And so then you start to wonder, like, is this next level that we're going to have these dashboards that are tracking our health and we're going to be okay with that because it's going to allow managers and companies to react in a more thoughtful way? Or, you know, where do you sort of see this going? Where is the line? What does healthy look like? I think this is a really interesting area to explore.
You've asked a really big question, and I'd like to answer it through two different lenses. I want to answer it through business owner, founder, where I have to wear my board hat. And then I'd like to answer it through the employee lens, because I'm actually been on both sides. And so let's start with the employee lens, because that's the most personal one. And I think that's the one that we all get the most worried about is, as you guys know, I've just, you know, battled cancer and I've been through that hellish ride, life-altering ride over the past 2 years. And this question went from theoretical to highly practical. You know what I mean? Because, like, I had to go to a board. I had to say to the board, I have been diagnosed with cancer. I had to tell a team I've been diagnosed with cancer. And there's real implications for that. There are certain periods of time where you cannot work. You cannot be a contributing member of the company. You know what I mean? And that means that responsibility and weight falls on other people that would have before been carried by you. That's where the question goes from theoretical to practical, because nobody wants to feel useless. Nobody wants to not be contributing. But the reality is that I've contributed significantly up until now, and now I need the company to carry me a little bit. You know what I mean? And so there's this debate that goes back and forth. And I think as an owner, there's a whole different layer to that. You know what I mean? Whereas at an employee level, there may not be the attachment and the tethering to the company that comes with being an owner of a company. But the reality still remains the same. You know what I mean? I think any mentally healthy, and I'm caveating it with that, mentally healthy, functional employee will not want to be carried by a company. They will want to be contributing. And so I think that's the fine line that companies are going to have to, like, when you're exposing that much data, you're going to have a framework that's been defined by the company of what do we do when people are unhealthy? Because I don't think we really want to admit how unhealthy 99% of the workforce really is. Not all the way to the level of major cancer diagnosis, but just general everyday functioning. I think when you actually lift the lid off and look at some of those just basic metrics, like what are people's, you know, general heart rates? Like what does their glucose metabolism look like? When you actually look at those like markers of health, people aren't as healthy as we think they are. They're not internally as healthy as they look on the outside, and that impacts work, you know. So do I have answers for it? No, I don't have answers for it, but I do know that business managers and leaders really do need to be looking at this and actually having a serious discussion about it, because that data is going to be hitting them very soon and they're going to have a game plan around what do we do with unhealthy.
I have a couple of things that I think are worth saying in this. One is I think everyone's going to have an AI, whether it's in their device or taking it all the way to the level of implanting it, that is your personal AI. Yeah. And it's going to know everything about you. I think this is inevitable. And I think once you have something that knows that much about someone, it's going to exceed how much the individual knows about themselves. And it's going to be able to process far beyond into things that individual didn't even realize and surface those insights. Well, if you have that kind of information and the organization sets the incentive right a person would be able to offer that information back to the organization in exchange for an incentive. And I could definitely see something like that.
See something. Yeah. You know what I mean? So to take what you've just said, I love what you've said there, like two steps further is once we see unhealthy, like, should it be the board's responsibility to come to me, Claire, and say, Claire, you have been diagnosed with cancer. You're not going to be able to contribute. We will provide a bot to do X work for you over this period. You know what I mean? Like that is the type of conversation we're going to have. You know what I mean? Who carries that expense? Again, we're facing a legal wall here. Like, are medical insurance companies going to fund bots to offset costs? You know what I mean? There's so many implications, like so many implications. And then to come back to my other lens that I wanted to answer this through is, and I'm going to choose to be very blunt here, is as a business owner, as a business owner, there is a very real part of me that just wants to say, hell no, I never want to see that data of any one of my employees. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. Like,
yeah,
I don't want to deal with people's mental health. I'm sorry. Yeah. It's just, it's too much.
It's a bridge too far. It's a bridge too far. Yeah. It can feel like a bridge too far. Yeah. But then what happens when all the other companies start doing it, right? What exactly happens then?
What happens then? I would be naive as a business owner if I thought that I could live in that reality. Because you can't. You can't.
It's so funny. So I wear a Whoop. My wife wears a Whoop. And even that, you know, it's like we're a happily married couple, but there's this level of intrusiveness of, oh, look at your sleep score last night versus mine. Or like your recovery was 19% and what are you trying to accomplish today? Like, and that could be toward me, that could be toward her. And she, you know, you're talking about, you know, measuring glucose and all these biomarkers. That's her world. She's a functional nutritionist and she studies metabolic health. So, you know, this world of blood and data and the story that's untold beneath the surface is very much part of my world. So I see it going there and I see how good these devices are getting. I mean, it's really amazing. And this is, you know, I don't know what I would call this, like generation two beyond a Fitbit. And there's not really any major AI in here. Like, my goodness.
Yeah,
exactly. And to your point, you know what I mean? Like, I've had thoughts. So like, as I've gone through this incredible journey of cancer and I've gotten into these like deep, deep metrics in my own body and realized how unhealthy the majority of the world is around me. Okay. I'm like, crikey, like, I really actually want to be hiring an employee who's willing to give me their glucose score because I know how this is impacting their work minute to minute. And then there's the other side of me that goes, hell no, I'm just going to pretend that they have great glucose readings.
Yeah. Yes. I love this. I love this conversation and I love the candor that we're having here because I think a lot of people don't want to think about that world, the digital bot plus human workforce that's emerging, and then the integration layers between those two things. It's inevitable. It's just good that we're having that conversation. And then I want to tie it back to something that you're doing. And I know that this product is emerging for all of you, and it's called Pattern. And it's a, you know, human beings run patterns. That's such a great name. And it's a product that illuminates progressive insights about people inside of an organization. And you can start to target things like when employees are overworked, when they have the wrong tools, if they're struggling with ineffective processes, if their stress is high, if their work-life balance is improving. And to your point, this is such a critical measure. And these ones feel progressive compared to where we've been, but they don't feel like a bridge too far. So could you just tell us a little bit more about kind of the why behind that? And then how are you making that actionable? Because this is where we always get to these things. You've got the device, it's giving you the data, but how do leaders make that actionable inside of an organization?
Like, what do you actually do with that? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So the whole, you know, if you, and you guys know this, because again, you're in industry, you're talking to business leaders. Business leaders are listening to this, and I know they're going to go, yes, yes, yes. There's three common things that we hear from every client that we talk to. My workplace feels like chaos. That's the actual word that's used. I have no visibility into my operations. Like, I can see people sitting in front of a computer if we're in an in-office, or I can see them on Zoom, but I've got no intel into the actual operations of what they're doing. And if I do have intel into those operations, I've got no accurate data that tells me where the blockages are and where things are going well. Okay. And so that's the basis of the problem that we're trying to solve for companies. Is we're not trying to solve the blockage, and we're not trying to solve that specific problem, because there's a lot of tools out there that can do that for you. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to surface the data, because ultimately the way people work today is the current trend, and if the current research shows us that an average human is jumping between 50 different systems on a daily basis. Now, just to give you guys an idea, that number was 18 just before the pandemic hit. Okay. So wow. We've gone 18 to, it's literally hovering around 49 right now. That's significant. That's almost like threefold growth. Okay.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, like, again, a number that we know that research underpins this, and we know this for a fact, you jump from one application. Like, I'm in this conversation with you right now. I go and I look at something on my phone because a pop-up blocked up. It takes my brain, my actual neurons, 20 minutes to refocus back on the original task again. Okay. So if you think about that, like 50 systems that we're jumping between, people are losing. Exactly. Like, the reality, if you go and do the actual math behind this, people are working for no more than 3 hours a day.
Wow. Yet
companies are literally, like, if you think about how performance structures are put together, how salary bands are constructed, how annual compensation is calculated, it's calculated on a 40-hour work week, expecting people to be working 8 hours a day. They're not. We're lying to ourselves. We're living in a false reality. We're only working 3 to 3.5 hours a day. That is the bottom line of the problem. And the only way we're going to start solving that, and this is, it's a really gnarly, ugly problem to solve, is by surfacing the data. Because yes, there's patterns in that data, but at the end of the day, each company is different. You know what I mean? Because the 50 tools that make up each company's suite of tools is different, you know? And so that's what we're aiming to do with Pattern. And I think we're starting to see the early signs of success around that, you know, with the companies that we're working with, is we are starting to surface data, and that data is actually telling a very meaningful story around, this is where the chaos is, and this is where you can start gaining those hours back. And our hope in the long term with this, and where we're going with it, is coming back to our conversation around the bot, is if you can surface where the issue is, where the repetitive blockage is happening, that's your, okay, this is where a bot needs to come in and work. You see what I mean? Because that's ultimately where we want to get to come. So, and I think that's what companies are grappling with right now. Like, AI has just exploded. But at a very basic level, like, companies genuinely don't know how to go and implement this. They're like,
yeah,
well, it's great, but like, where do I actually go and start with this? You know?
Yes.
And I want to be able to, my vision with the product and what has now become the team's vision is, we want to be able to go to an executive and say, yes, your data set, this is your data, and this is where we suggest you can start looking at where meaningful AI applications would be useful to you.
That's fantastic. And deeply needed on the individual level, on the team level, on the organizational level, because it's happening. That kind of, what do I do next? What do I do now? Question is happening at all three levels.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is part and parcel to something that we're, you know, exploring on the show, exploring with our guests, and exploring with our clients, which is, you know, how do you roll this in thoughtfully with an experimenter's mindset against the core values of your company, against, you know, the particular situations and use cases? Do you need to go big on AI, or can you really do something that's a little more discreet, a little more thoughtful? You know, this idea that a lot of companies are looking to just make that one bold move or hire a chief AI officer, there's a lot of reactivity as opposed to thoughtfulness. And I think talking about the data is really powerful. I definitely want to talk about time management and the time management crisis. We know that's near and dear to you. But before we do, I want to just do one more nudge and kind of zoom out on this sort of bigger mental health state of the workforce question. So you are measuring core metrics like engagement, trust, and stress. And as most people know, the foreboding headlines about work today are discussing quiet quitting, quiet firing, disengagement, low trust, high burnout, and of course, poor mental health, which we were just talking about. So is the data that you're seeing, is it showing that things are getting better or worse?
I'm going to say something that may shock the audience. I don't think things are nearly as bad as the media and the headline is saying they are. And I don't think that people understand how good stress actually is. So, Nate, you like looking at me and you like shaking your head.
I'm like waiting. Where is this going to go?
So, okay, let's go back a little bit. I think what we need to remember is that we live in an age where things happen in echo chambers, okay? Yes. Because of personalization on the internet. Yes. So you click on one article that's headline has the word stress in it, and all of a sudden, everything popping up into your feed is going to be linked to that. And we completely underrate how significant that impact is on us because it is an echo chamber. We literally bounce from one echo chamber to another. And so, and I've actually been very actively experimenting with this, like where 1 week I will choose, okay, this is what I'm going to click on this week. And then I see how my feed changes. And it's, you know what I mean? And so I think the people who are focusing on that stress thing, that echo chamber is really big right now. Okay. And then if you go, so that's the first thing that I want to say. And that is where my statement is coming from, is that the reality is that we're all in many ways fooled by the internet because the internet is not actually an actual reflection of what reality really is. It's just a reflection of what you're obsessing over right now. I think a lot of people would be surprised that not everybody's obsessing over stress right now. Not everybody's stressed. Not everybody is feeling, you know, mentally tired. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that if you go and look, and I'm an extremely data-driven person, okay? Like a practical example, get diagnosed with cancer, and I literally spend 3 days straight, barely sleep, 72 hours, and I just read journal articles. And I don't make any decision about my diagnosis until I've touched at least 5,000 journal articles. It's just how I am. Okay? And so, every single thing that I've done from a work perspective within the company, from the product development perspective, I've come at it with that same data perspective. Okay. And if you look at what the data teaches us, and I've like spanned huge areas of research here. So I've gone and I've looked like high performance sports people. I've looked at actual evolutionary data, like at a biological level within humans and within animals across the board. Stress is actually a really critical piece of how we function and what gets us through the day, okay? And if you look, like somebody else that I want to recommend that you guys, he's a really good friend of ours. His name is Eric Quorum. He has a PhD in sleep, and he used to work with the NFL team around high performance. And this is actually like one of the big things that he goes on about is that aside from sleep, which is like his life, work, and mission, he's like, it's not about reducing stress. It's about building adaptation to manage stress. And I think that's where the conversation needs to evolve to, because that's the only way. Like, the stress is not going to go away. Like, companies can't minimize the stress. Companies can't take the individual personal stress away. It's about creating a workforce and enabling a workforce to build adaptation and adaptive capacity for the stress that's coming their way. And that's what we're also seeing. You can see that, like, from the companies that we've looked at and worked with inside Pattern, you can see that there's a set of employees who have adaptive capacity and they can handle significantly more stress than the people on the ground who don't have adaptive capacity. And that research rings true in so many fields. You know what I mean? And it literally comes right down to evolutionary biology. The organisms that had the adaptive capacity are the ones that are here and that survived. The ones who didn't, died.
I mean, we are absolutely in a moment where adaptation and adaptability is more important than ever because we're dealing with such rapid and incessant and pervasive change. And so I think that makes it particularly hard. Nate has a great quote that he loves to share where he says, easy doesn't change you, right? You know, we all want to sit in a hammock by the beach, but there is data about, I don't remember who did it. You probably do, but there is absolutely data about good stress that shows a certain level of stress really improves who we are, allows us to grow, and is good for the immune system and the body. There is also bad stress though. Can you unpack what is bad stress? Give us an example of bad stress.
Okay, so Gilday, I want to say something. I genuinely don't believe there is bad stress. And this is coming from somebody who has grown up in South Africa. I've been held up at gunpoint multiple times in my life. My car has been hijacked. Like, I've dealt with trauma in my life. I've seen trauma. I've seen bad stuff. Okay? I genuinely don't believe that if you look at this purely from a biological level, I don't believe that there is such a thing as bad stress and good stress. I believe that as an organism, the human body and the human mind needs to be trained to handle stress, irrespective of whether it's perceived as bad stress in the moment or good stress. And yeah, I want to reference a book, and I cannot recommend this book enough, called Widening the Window. And the author of this book actually goes through the whole neurobiological process that happens in our bodies where, and again, this is backed up by intensive amounts of research where you can see how an organism is either trained to deal with stress, no matter how traumatic it is or not. And the whole premise of the book is we're living in an age where, for whatever reason, our windows are actually extremely narrow, and there's multiple contributing factors to that. But we have biologically within us the ability to widen that window. And if we do that work, stress won't feel bad anymore. Stress won't, you know what I mean? Because we'll have the ability in our bodies to process that.
That's fascinating. The pearl of wisdom that I just got out of all of that is this whole conversation about everyone's overstressed is actually not the conversation at all. It's how do we change our meaning and our association to stress entirely so that we can start to function at a completely different level. And I am down for that. Thank you.
If you think about it, like, what's beautiful about this is, like, we're not even at the end of our conversation, but it's actually, we've come right back to the very beginning where we started. Biology and work are going to have to start marrying themselves. And that's the crux of it. I think if that was the summary that I was to take out of how this conversation has unfolded is that I think we're underrating how powerful our systems, our neurological system and the rest of our body is in its ability to actually heal us in real time when we're faced with stress. And because we're undereducated about it, and in some cases not educated at all about it, we're not harnessing it. And so we're actually making ourselves sick.
That leads us perfectly into the question that I'm about to ask you, and I'm going to reveal a truth about me. Coming into this podcast, I was in 4 time zones in 4 days, and I was trying to do more than was possible as a single person in that time frame, and my body was trying to navigate a lot of what isn't normal as it was moving through those time zones. And the first thing that I did was I gave up sleep and I gave up working out so that I could try to get all the things done. I know cognitively, I know intellectually that that is a recipe for disaster, but I was in that moment of like, I have to do all this stuff. There's no option. that I have to get on the plane. Everything has to be done for, you know? And so I wanted to ask you about this really interesting time management, sleep management question. And your research shows that on average, we're losing 8.5 days a month of time trying to get everything done. And we're often doing it at the detriment of sleep, exercise, and the things that really matter. And I wanted to be the one to say, I just went through that cycle. So what do we do?
Okay. Do you guys mind if I just back up a little bit, just for the sake of everybody listening to this, and share where I actually came to that calculation?
Okay. Yes, please. That would be great.
It actually ties into the previous segment that we've just been talking about, where people are like business leaders are coming to us and they're saying, my people are overworked, my people are stressed. Like, everybody has the sense of not enough time. Like, what do we do about it? And I got so annoyed hearing this, and I got so annoyed hearing it from my own team and my own leadership team. I was like, I need to get to the bottom of this. Like, where is this actually coming from? Okay. Because like you, I find myself buying into it at times as well. And I'm like, I know that this is not really the reality, but I need to dig into this. So here's what I did. I literally sat with a piece of paper, okay, at my dining room table, and I wrote down everything that I need to do and how long it takes me. Okay. And I measured it for 3 weeks because I wanted to have like I wanted to actually have a running calculation to see what things average out at. Okay. And I broke it down. I was like, this is how long it takes to eat every day. This is how long it takes to exercise. This is how long it takes to sleep. This is how long it takes to parent. This is how long it takes to do school runs. And I broke it down into like minuscule things like that. And that's how I came up with the number. And you know how frightening it is? I put that because I then put it on a slide and I've shared it with audiences subsequent to that. Do you know that people like literally their jaws drop when I actually put that thing up, when I put that slide up, and they're like, yes, yes, this explains everything. Like, we are living in a time deficit. Like, we are, if you go and you look, and you know what's scary is, if you actually go and add in everything else that we're doing, so that initial calculation of mine, okay, it doesn't include things like parental care. It doesn't include things like date night and time with your friends. It doesn't include all the stuff that we're actually doing. Like, this was just the basic bare minimums of living. Okay. It doesn't include the time we spend on social media. If you start adding all of that in, we're in excess of like 100 days deficit a year.
Well, and you just gave me the idea of doing another calculation of the compounding impact of every time that I'm missing sleep. How much sleep did I miss? And then starting to look at that over a week and look at that over a month and then totaling those hours and going, exactly. Oh my gosh, the most important restorative piece in my life, I'm completely neglecting it.
Yeah, completely neglecting it. And so, like, you look at that calculation and all of a sudden you have this epiphany. Okay, well, that is why I'm feeling as tired, because I literally am. I'm living in a deficit of time. I'm doing things that I actually need 100 more days for to do. Okay. And then that's where the reality drops. That's why I'm not sleeping. That's why I'm not exercising. You know what I mean? That, and so you have this really like moment where you kind of like, I'm going to have to do something about this because this is not sustainable. You know what I mean? I can pretend that I didn't just do this calculation and I can keep going the way I'm going, but something has got to give at some point in time. And that's where you start realizing you've got to become really relentless about what you say yes and no to. You know what I mean? Like, is it really important to go and scroll through Instagram right now? Is it really important to watch that TikTok reel? Is it, you know, should we really be on this podcast right now? Those are the questions we should all be asking. And I don't think that we
I'll see you guys later.
All right, let's wrap it up right here.
It's such a personal thing, but I think it's an exercise that everybody actually needs to go and do is where am I really spending my time and how much time do I actually have?
But what you've done is people forever have been saying less is more. And they've been saying things like focus on what matters most. But what you did, which is so data driven and rigorous and beautiful, is you said, no, you need to actually look at how much of a deficit you're operating at. And then that will give you the evidence you need to go, oh, wow, I really am cutting these things out because this is unsustainable.
Yeah. And then if you take that to the company level, because this isn't only at the personal level. So yes, my challenge to everybody here is we should go and do this at a personal level, but at a company level, this gets really exciting because now for the first time, if you actually go and get each of your employees to do this, but through the work lens, okay, as companies, we're pretending that people are working 8 hours a day. They're not. Let's just accept that reality. Let's just accept that people are working 3.5 hours a day because that's the truth. Okay. So if that is the truth, we essentially can use AI to make up the other 4.5 hours. Mm. Do you see what I mean? And so that's where you can start getting really, really practical about this is what do I think this set of employees should be doing in those 4 hours that they're not? And how can I use AI to back that up? Okay. So that all of a sudden AI feels a lot more tangible and a lot more real because you can actually start breaking that up into groups of employees. You know what I mean? So is it your legal staff? Is it your HR staff? Is it your marketing team? You know what I mean? And you can start getting down to that. And all of a sudden, your implementation of AI becomes really practical because you can put a number behind it. Is this AI giving me 4 hours back? Like, that's a great metric to track.
It is.
Beautiful success metric.
And we are getting there, absolutely, with Gen AI, with the tools. I mean, we are seeing the productivity lift across the board for sure. But I do want to spend another second talking about how do you help people with practical takeaways? So I think for this time management crisis that you're talking about, so I think first and foremost is the values-driven conversation. You know, how much does this matter to me personally? Hacks that are often offered up are, you know, making your to-do list of your 3 to 5 most important things, doing those things right away, top of the morning, when you're fresh, Pomodoro timers. You've talked about time boxing for tasks rather than having a task list. You say, hey, I'm going to give myself 20 minutes or 30 minutes and whatever level of fidelity I can get this done in that amount of time. That's the effort and that's the output. I think that's really interesting. I actually use a color coding of my calendar. And I really like that because it gives me a visualization of, hey, I got a lot of green on here. Green's work. I got some family time, but my personal practice, you know, my meditation, ice bath, therapy, not a lot of boxes on that this week. Or, you know, the gym, which is blue. Hey, less blue this week. I'm feeling a little low energy-wise. Need more blue in there. I would love to ask, what other tools would you recommend for people to feel a greater sense of control over their lives and schedule? I think AI is a great answer. I think we're going to get there. I agree with you. I don't think we're there. We're not there yet. And so in the interim, what would you offer up to give people a sense of finding more order in the chaos of their lives?
I'm going to answer this question very personally. I'm going to share with you what I'm doing in my own life. I'm a mom of 3. I sit on multiple boards. I'm an athlete who takes my training very seriously. I'm busy. I'm very, very busy. So these are the things I'm doing to get through everything with a smile at the end of the day. The first thing I'm doing is, and this is actually an evolution, well, not even an evolution, it's a variation of what you're doing, Alex, is I don't just have the colors on my calendar, but I actually have a blueprint calendar. So it's a calendar layered over my actual calendar. And I've gone and I've looked at, so at the start of every single year, I've got like an idea paint wall in my office, and I lay out visually on that wall my goals for the year. Okay. And then I take those goals and I basically go, okay, in order to achieve this set of goals, like what does my calendar on a day-to-day basis need to look like? So I've actually blueprinted chunks of time across the whole week. So There's a whole chunk of time that has to be dedicated to the building of our family office and our family brand and everything related to that and all of the board work that we do. Okay. So there's like a chunk for that. There's a chunk for the companies that I'm involved in. Okay. Like all my board work there and everything there that I have to do. So there's a chunk for that. There's some non-negotiables, like my training is non-negotiable. There's a chunk for that every single day. There's a chunk for date night. There's time for the kids. And I've mapped it out. And then what I do is as requests for meetings come in and everything like that, I match it to the blueprint. So if somebody related to the foundation that we're building for the family wants to meet with me, if my foundation block is full, then I'm like, can't meet with you this week. I can meet with you next week. Or if it has to happen this week, I'll move something out of that block. So with about 85% accuracy every single week, stick to that blueprint. And cumulatively over time, I get a lot done because I'm blueprinting it. You know what I mean? It's like, and I know what are non-negotiables. Like, I am not allowed to cancel training, period. You know what I mean? It's just like, I don't do it. That is a non-negotiable for me. So that's the first thing I do. The second thing I do, and this is simplistic, but it's surprisingly hard for people to do. But I found that the more I flex this muscle, the easier it's become. I'm just relentless at saying no. I say no to cocktail events. I say no to conferences. I say no to travel. I say no to meetings. I say no to dinner dates. I say no to friends. I say no to family. I just say no. You know what I mean? You've got to get really, really good at saying no. And I've actually found an incredible amount of joy in saying no and just being present.
I'm gonna jump ahead because I feel like it's the right moment to do this and bridge two things. I'm taking a leap here and I'm going to try to bridge two things. You're a cancer survivor and you just went through something tremendous and traumatic. And there is nothing like mortality to wake us up. I have a hunch that your ability to have clarity and say no, it has been significantly heightened by what you just went through. Is that fair?
Yes, that is. It is very, very, very fair. So here's the interesting thing. Our family is like riddled with cancer. Like we've had all four. My grandparents died of it. Both my parents have had it. You know what I mean? So I went and I actively pursued this. Like I actually put myself on a surveillance program with the doctors. I was like, you are going to do genetic testing on me. You are going to put me through an MRI machine every year. And so we found it because I was so proactive about it. So I didn't go through the shock of, oh my word, you know what I mean? I'm facing death here, because I actually went and actively, as I call it, I went and scratched around in Pandora's box. And so when you proactively go and scratch there, you know what I mean? You're expecting to find stuff. It has been the most transformative experience for me in that I chose to like really just go deep into it. Like I got to the bottom of why did that gene mutate? Why did I get breast cancer? Like that, I was hell-bent on finding that answer. And getting to the bottom of that has just opened up a whole world to me, which is incredible. And when you dive into the incredibleness that is our human biology, I think you develop a very deep respect for life itself. And that's where you start realizing, I want more life. I'm not running away from death. I want more life. And so every choice becomes filtered through that. I want life.
That is so beautiful. Thank you for revealing that. A lot of people are in moments like that and they actually go to great lengths to hide it from people. And you, by you bringing this and just offering it to everyone and then using it as a through line for everything that you're doing is unbelievably powerful. So thank you.
Thanks, Nate. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's been an honor to actually go through it.
Yeah. Can I continue to scratch a little bit at it?
Of course you can. Absolutely. Okay.
We've been in and out of this AI conversation and you just went through this cancer experience. And I wanted to ask you, having gone through that, what kind of implications do you see there? And does that seem inevitable?
That's an interesting one, that inevitable question. So I basically had this very interesting experience. As the universe would have it, so I just to give a little bit of history, yeah, I was diagnosed with breast cancer during my first trimester of pregnancy. So it's not just cancer, this is, during pregnancy, okay? So a lot of things to deal with there. And you won't believe it, it just so happens that one of the world's leading researchers in cancer during pregnancy, in breast cancer specifically, happens to be in Dallas where I am. Like, how incredible is that? Okay.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing.
It's absolutely incredible. And so she's based out of UT Southwestern, which is one of the research hospitals here in Dallas. But then for some reason, they decided to do all of my imaging at another hospital. Okay. And it was the experience between these two hospitals in Dallas, which really brought to the forefront how critical this AI journey is that we are going to go on. One hospital, profound experience. Like, I cannot describe to you how incredible it was to actually be a patient in that hospital. To give you guys an idea, I had my first meeting with my oncologist. She laid out the diagnosis for me. She had the diagram and everything like that. Amazing. Like, gave me all the time in the world, allowed me to ask my questions, allowed Mark as my husband to ask all his questions, sent us on our way after like a 90-minute meeting, didn't rush us at all. And 2 days later, I receive a personalized book. And I'm not lying to you. It's like a manual this thick. Okay. In the post, and it's personalized. It is a book for Claire. It has my name in it, okay, from the hospital, detailing my cancer diagnosis with visual diagrams, okay?
Wow.
The implications of it, diet factors, like everything that you can think of. And it ends with personalized testimonials that they have gone and gotten from cancer patients who were pregnant and diagnosed with cancer. Like, can you, like, I'm getting goosebumps just telling you about
it. I have goosebumps right now just listening to that. Yeah. It's
unbelievable.
Like,
it's unbelievable.
The human touch. Okay, let's grab this beautiful piece of wisdom. The human touch. We talk about the transactional nature, the efficiencies, the scale of digital, and digital is great. We love it. It's great. But it can never be that thing that you just got right there, where someone sees you, they hear you, they experience you deeply. And then they go, I'm going to go to a level you never even imagined to be on this journey with you. And I'm sorry, for all the greatness of digital, it is nowhere near something like that.
Exactly. And I'm using this point. And then I had this experience with the other hospital where it was everything that we know medicine to be. Just horrible. It's just the number. It's just dragged in. You know what I mean? I had to keep repeating what I was going through. I had to keep repeating my things. You know what I mean? It's the traditional thing that we all hate, the horrible hospital experience. And it was so interesting to have these contrasting experiences, like walking this road at exactly the same time. And my realization was that is what AI is going to enable. It's that. And I was on a panel where somebody asked me about this, and they summarized it beautifully. They said, you were in dialogue with your hospital care team. It was a dialogue that was happening. They were seeing you. You were asking questions. You were getting answers in return. They saw you. They really saw you. And I think that's the beauty of AI, is that it's going to enable that type of scale, because if you think about it, it's going to take a really powerful AI tool to be able to swim through a set of hospital systems to gather all of that data about me as a client, to make me feel that special, but to be able to do it en masse. You can't do that at scale.
Yeah.
You have to have AI to be able to do that. And so that's the beautiful piece. This is where I get so exceptionally excited about AI, is that it can take that human piece and it can allow us to be those humans, and then it can give us all the stuff that we need to amplify it.
Claire, I want to acknowledge that we've talked about the chaos of work, how hard it is to get through it, the challenges of health and mortality and time management. But on the other side of that are the prospects for longevity. And the current lifespan in the U.S. for men is 79. For women, it's 83. However, there are a lot of prominent biohackers and doctors and forward-thinking nutrition experts who believe that 120 and beyond is very possible soon. And you said you aspire to live to be 189, right?
What?
Alec, I'm going to do it. Watch
you
this
are
space.
Going to live. To, yes, I'm sorry. That was not the right affirmation tone. Excuse me. Now, I'm a junior varsity biohacker. And I think it would be absolutely amazing to talk in detail with you about this. But I want to leave this as a cliffhanger because I think we need to have you come back to the show and do a whole conversation on biohacking. But I want to leave this as a frame that this is going to radically change the workforce. And in your own words, employers and companies are not even remotely ready for this. Related to this, you're on the board of XPRIZE, which is, in your words, a community of the world's best minds and the largest funder of scientifically backed competitions that solve the issues facing humanity at the present. Now, we just talked about biohacking and longevity, but I would love, just before we finish up, to get a couple high-level insights from you, your insider's lens on what XPRIZE innovations are going to have the greatest impact on the future of work and the advancement of AI.
Alex, yes. First of all, I would absolutely love to come back and talk about biohacking and longevity. I think that is a whole, and I think there should be other people on that call. I'm definitely not an expert in this area, but like you, I'm...
We'll do a round robin. It'll be great.
Yeah, let's do it.
We'll do a round robin on it. But I like tinkering in that area as well, and it's an area of huge passion for me. I think if we were to bring the whole conversation full circle, if you think about what my very first response was, biology, human biology, neuropsychology is going to come together with work in a way that has always been this hard line of we don't mix these two. And I think if you look at particularly the work of XPRIZE, they've literally actually just in the last few months launched their biggest competition ever. It's in excess of 100 million. That they are awarding to companies, and it's specifically around longevity. And I think where companies really need to start really putting a lot of thought into is you're no longer retiring people out at 65. Your best workforce has actually just arrived at the door. And so the scary piece, and this is where I don't think young people, and when I say young people, I'm talking about people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, don't realize that this aging population is actually going to become their biggest competition because they have more wisdom, more experience, more like literal visuals on patterns in life and evolution cycles and everything like that, which makes them a much, much stronger worker. And if what we're saying about AI and if we're saying what we're saying about longevity is true, these people are going to have the mental wherewithal and the physical wherewithal to outpace a 20, 30, and a 40-year-old significantly. And so the challenge that's facing workforces...
With an upgraded wisdom chip.
Exactly. And so if you look at where the conversation is focused right now is... Companies are stressing because they're like, well, and they're thinking about like insurance companies are thinking about how are we going to support these people from a medical perspective and how are we going to keep them around, you know, like paying out disbursements and stuff. Where I think companies should actually be focusing is how are we going to spend our money to actually bring 20, 30, and 40-year-olds up to speed because they're going to be so ineffective. And I don't see the conversation happening there at all. And that worries me. That really worries me because there's this gap, which is essentially the future, but it needs so much more investment now than it ever needed before.
you're right. We're not there. And I just saw an interview with Ray Kurzweil the other day, and he said, look, all I have to do is, you know, I think it was live another 5 years, and then I'm going to be able to live decades longer. He believes that, you know, biohacking, yeah, longevity science is moving that quickly. So I don't know if Ray's right, but there's quite a lot in this space that makes it very, very interesting.
I think that Ray is very right. And I think that another book that I can recommend that I can throw out there, written by a current Congress member, yeah, in the US, it's called 2054. It's a sequel to a book called 2034. Highly recommend it. Touches very strongly on the topic of remote gene editing. And Ray is actually mentioned personally in that book because of the work that he does in this area. And I don't think he's wrong at all. I think we don't quite grasp how far along the changes in this area are.
Like, I think we also don't quite grasp how close all of this stuff is. You know, I think we've been so mired in the chaos and the disruption of the last 4 years that when we stop and talk about this, I'm just in goosebumps over and over again of like, this is going to happen. We're going to be in this world.
Yes. Like, we're actually going to be in this world. Like, I mean, this book touches on, I'm giving the book away now, but like, I'm going to do it, is I'm going to be the spoiler. Like, a president is assassinated because his heart is remotely edited by his biggest adversary. And it is not, like, this is real. This is real.
This is not Black Mirror. This is within the realm.
This is not Black Mirror. This is Ray and people like him are working on this stuff. Like, this is real.
In a good way. In a good way. not in the assassination way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Like, the ground that we've covered here has been so amazing and illuminating and counterintuitive. Like, some of the things that you're giving us are exciting to wrestle with. So to bring this home, we're going to take you into a speed round. Okay, you have 60 seconds. 60 seconds. We're going to ask you 5 questions, and you just go with whatever comes off your tongue.
60 seconds per question, not total.
Per question. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. That would be a real speed round. 5 questions that would be 60 seconds. Okay. First question. To prepare for your TED Talk, you sent out 1 survey question. And now on TDW, we're going to pose it back to you. If you can tell me 1 thing about the future of work, what is it you would say?
Start tracking your metabolic health because your boss is going to start looking at it.
You are a pilot, and there have to be 1 or 2 critical lessons from being a pilot that relates to the future work.
The thing that scares people most, which in the case of flying is mostly turbulence, is an absolute non-factor. The most dangerous phase of flight is takeoff, and nobody is stressed when the plane is taking off. We're focused on the things we shouldn't be focused on.
Ooh, that was good.
Your husband, Mark, drum roll please, is going to space. Is this an example of building play into your work and life?
Hell yes.
Go, Mark.
Awesome.
Hell yeah. It absolutely is. Yeah. He's a total space nerd. Total space nerd.
That is so cool. Something that I'm sure our audience doesn't know about you is that you are a sheep farmer, and you say that sheep have something really important to do with the future work. What is it?
They actually do, believe it or not. I'm so happy you asked this question. I think the biggest lesson that I've learned in becoming a sheep farmer is it's not the sheep directly. It's the whole economy of our lives that we need to relook at. I don't think we realize how the production systems that we've allowed ourselves to become part of, like whether that's the food production cycle or, you know, anything like that, is controlled by such a small group of people in the US particularly, but I know because I lived in Europe for 10 years as well, it's the same issue over there as well in Africa too, which is where I was born. We're facing a crisis that nobody's talking about and nobody's thinking about. And I think people need to get really serious about going back to the basics of where is my food coming from? Why am I buying it from here? And what is inside of it? And I don't want to sound like a doomsday prophet, but seriously, as I've gone down that road, because I've had to do my research and everything in terms of setting the farm up, I've been alarmed at what I've found. Like, who controls food cycles? How few companies actually control it? What actually happens on farms with the food that we eat, et cetera? Yeah, and it all comes from Google. Biohacking.
Last question. You said, quote, if people are going to spend 90% of their time at work, it should be the place where souls, hearts, and minds come alive. What's one story of inspiration at work where souls, hearts, and minds came alive for you?
Oh, there's so many. Like, only 60 seconds on this one. It's actually, I told you guys I don't want to talk about this, and now you're forcing me to talk about it. I think it's every time that I build a team and I become irrelevant. That for me is my moment of like the moment where I'm no longer needed in the company and I'm literally useless. My entire being ignites.
Wow.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Nate told me that I was literally useless like the first week we started, but I don't think he meant it in the same way.
What? Claire? Never mind.
Hold on. I want to say one thing. I think the title of this episode should be "The Future of Work is Chaos. Don't be a sheep and live forever."
Oh my gosh.
I love it.
That is awesome.
I love it.
You have said things that have caused me to rethink my position. And I am so excited by that. Thank you for being counterintuitive. Thank you for being vulnerable. Thank you for sharing about your cancer and connecting that back to what we are all going through and the chaos that we're experiencing, but how we need to reassociate and change the meaning on how we're experiencing this stress. And just the insights around the future of work, health, AI, longevity, right? Reimagining the workforce of the future because we're living longer. I loved every minute of this. I am grateful. We are grateful. Thank you for joining the show.
Guys, thank you so much for having me. Honestly, it's an honor. It's not every day that I get to work with two people like yourselves that put so much effort into what you're doing. It really means a lot. This is good work. This is artisanship. This is craft. So thank you. You guys, really, it's an honor to be working with you guys.
Claire, where can people find you and learn more about your incredible work, connect with you, and all of the things to amplify the great work you're doing in the world?
All of the things. So if you want to see my incredible fat ass sheep, and they literally have fat asses, there's a whole story behind that. Go look on Instagram. My fat ass sheep are there. If you want to have a conversation with me, I'm on Twitter. I don't appear very active, but I literally am there. I'm listening in on a lot of conversations and very happy to debate with you there. I do a lot of connecting on LinkedIn, so I'd love to connect with people there. Just, you know, send me a message and say it was on this podcast that I heard you. And naturally, you can email me as well, claire@wonder.com or claire@hadar.family. Very happy to chat. And my telephone number is on my website as well. So,
oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow.
Claire,
thank you.
Thank you again. This is magnificent.
Thank you so much, guys. It's been great.